It's Saturday morning, and it's time for the Beacon. Good morning, Mrs. Kleeman.
Good morning, Mr. Jurek.
It is nothing like fall in Chicago.
I love it. You know what? I love it. And I say that so unfacetiously. Like, I spent last summer, not this past summer, the summer before in California.
Right.
And I was so ready to get back to the Chicago fall. And I don't say that much, but
it just smells good.
It does.
It really does.
It's so lovely.
It's like wintertime after a snowfall.
Yeah.
Did you walk outside and you go...
It's so peaceful.
And, it's quiet
exactly.
Because of the blanket of the snow.
Yes.
And that air is so crisp
yep.
and clean and everything
See,
else.
See, you get me.
That's it.
You're speaking my language.
See, and then the thing is, I used to live out in the country where they allowed leaf burning.
Oh, really?
Oh, there's nothing like the smell of burning leaves in the fall.
I bet.
And you take your marshmallow on a stick and you put it over the
I love that.
It's everything good about fall.
I know.
With the pumpkins.
Going to the pumpkin farm. See, that's one thing that we've got pumpkin farms in California, but I never grew up going to, like out here, it's an event. It's a day-long event. You go and they've got rides and hay rides and corn mazes and pig races.
And hot cider and
roasted corn.
Everything.
Oh my
goodness. It's just better than life itself.
It really is.
It's fall, and we officially are in fall, by the way.
Yes,
this
we are.
Weekend.
The 25th.
This is the first weekend that we're officially.
4 days away.
Hey.
T-minus 4 days.
And counting.
That's right.
That's it. You know, and then all of a sudden you won't be able to stand up straight.
I know.
What do you want? Dog is here. He's looking for something. I think we talked about food.
I think he did, actually. I think he perked right up there.
He thought, ooh, food? We talking food?
Roasted corn?
Yeah, it's got to be better. Thank you. It's got to be better than that kibble you give me every morning.
Oh, yeah.
For Pete's sake,
no doubt. No doubt. Good.
So what do we do? Oh, autism.
Yeah.
Interesting study.
Is there? Ann Rux is going to be talking to us about it.
She is from the, and I forget the two letters, and she wasn't very emphatic about those two letters going before the Drexel Autism Institute.
The Drexel Autism Institute.
Which is part of the of Drexel University, which I didn't know existed in Philadelphia until I had a chance to speak with her.
Well, excellent. She's going to be describing the latest study regarding autism in adults,
Did you ever stop and think, whatever happened, we are inundated with information about autism for children.
Yes.
But what happens when they get older?
Well, you know, here's the thing is I think there's so much focus on how autism is what causes autism that once a person has it, there's not a lot of research that at least we hear about after the fact. It seems like most of the resources are focused on what causes it, how to prevent it, et cetera, et cetera. But once you have it, all right, research is done, but
yeah,
so that's interesting.
And then about living independently and all the rest of the stuff that goes along with it. So it was a very, very interesting interview.
Cool.
And I think you'll get some information.
I'm looking forward to it. Autism is very interesting to me.
Very much so.
Yes.
And then what do we have?
After that, we're going to be talking about Juan Suarez. Talking with Juan Suarez. He's going to be talking with one of the participants in the seniors program here
yes.
at the Lighthouse.
He's got a few of them that they're handpicking to put on the radio, and there are really some very exciting stories. There's even a lady down there. She's in her well up into her 90s.
Aww.
Walks with a walker, makes sure she comes, learns that computer.
Love it. I love
God
it.
God bless her when you get
you
other people
what?
Sit on their duff at 75 and say they're old.
Right. Exactly.
Sheesh,
exactly. I have a 93-year-old grandmother who doesn't take any medication. She still lives independently. She is fit as a fiddle, and I adore her. I mean, it's just so rare to see. She was going to the gym up until a couple of years ago, and then I think her eyesight got a little poor, and so she just didn't feel comfortable. But she stopped driving. But aside from, she lives in Hemet in a retirement community. Hemet, it's like in the middle of the desert in Southern California.
I thought maybe there was like Hermit.
Hemet.
Hemet.
H-E-H-E-M-E-T.
It's not
but yeah, I mean, bless their hearts, you know.
What's the name of that town?
Sebastopol.
Sebastopol.
Sebastopol. That's the town I grew up in, by the way, that's for right. those of you who are wondering and what I'm talking about.
And Mom lives now in another exotically named
Cotati.
Town. Cotati. Cotati, that's
yep.
right.
Yep. Good old Sonoma County.
Oh, Lord, if those people ever come down to Earth. And then what? After our visit with one.
And then we'll be talking to me about our lettuce
right.
turnip the beet.
That's right. And then it'll be a lot of fun. So we should get things started.
Let's do it.
I'm Bill Jurek.
I'm Lainey Kleeman.
Stick around for information about adult autism.
Hello, I'm Bill Curtis. From its simple beginnings right here on Chicago's West Side, where it was founded in 1906, it has grown into one of America's most comprehensive social service agencies, serving people who are blind or visually impaired. Today, the Chicago Lighthouse offers world-class services in vision care, adaptive technology, job training and placement, rehabilitation, education, and many other areas. As more and more elderly Americans cope with vision loss, the Lighthouse will face greater challenges in expanding its critical programs. To see how you can help, please call 312-666-1331 or visit us at chicagolighthouse.org. The Chicago Lighthouse, seeing what's possible for more than 100 years.
You know, over the past few years, autism has come to the forefront of everyone's attention in America because we thought that the numbers were a lot higher than they were as far as the onset of autism in children. But we see that number every time, it seems like every time almost the study comes out, it seems like it's a smaller ratio. We'd like to get some clarification on that, and also the fact that there are adults out there who are people who have suffered, or I don't want to say suffered. Ann Rue is with us. She's from the A.J. Drexel Autism Institute at Drexel University in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Ann, how are you? Nice to have you with us. And I want to make sure I word this the right way, because it's not really an affliction, but what would be the proper term for autism? Is it just a mental illness, or considered part of a mental illness?
Some people classify it under the category of mental health.
Mental health, okay.
But most people will call it a neurodevelopmental disorder.
Okay. And I think what we have seen over the years, and you, I'm sure you'll agree, is that many times it was misdiagnosed over the years. That a lot of times people or educators or even some people in the medical field would look at it as being a more like an ADHD or an ADD problem, that sort of thing. Where in reality, there are different stages of autism. There's a whole scale as far as autism is concerned, from extremely light to the more severe, right?
Well, and just to back up a little bit, yes, it is true that over the years we have found that as the number of children with autism who receive special ed services has increased, mm-hmm. we also see a decrease in the number of children who have intellectual disabilities. So many children probably were misdiagnosed originally, were thought to have other things like intellectual disabilities, when in fact they probably had autism. So we call this a diagnostic shift or a diagnostic substitution. It's not that they weren't there originally, it's that they were called something else.
Now,
in some populations, particularly those who may be disadvantaged, African-American children did tend to be overdiagnosed with ADHD and behavior disorders instead of autism. So we see that also.
Okay, now this is a little bit out of your realm of focus, but what have they determined causes autism? The diagnosis is, you know, what have they come to a conclusion on? What is it? Environment? Is it nutrition prior to birth? Is there anything in particular?
A lot more clues about that
yeah.
than we had prior to now in time. the answer is still not definitive. We have many more genetic clues than we had before, that we know that there are a host of genes that likely contribute to the disorder in many people. And we know that there are probably triggers mm-hmm. that then set off the expression of those genes, but we don't know specifically what those triggers are yet. And I think that's the million-dollar question everyone would like to know.
Sure. Now let's take this focus. There are people who are misdiagnosed or shift diagnosed and do have autism. They have gone through school. They have experienced being considered to have, like I said earlier on, the ADD, the ADHD, that sort of thing. And then they become adults. And is this where they start to run into a problem because there's no support level for them or there's no support team for them at that point?
Well, you can think about this in two ways. So, first there's a group of people that did receive a diagnosis and help during their school years. Mm-hmm. And so we are able to follow what happens to those people by looking at some of our national survey data. And then there's another group of people, though, that did not access the diagnosis or maybe didn't receive a diagnosis until much later, perhaps after high school or into college. And what happens then to those people, we know less about because typically they aren't included in national survey data, but we certainly hear from many adults who are receiving diagnoses later in life and are often struggling to figure out what that means for their life and then mm-hmm. figure out what would be helpful for them in improving the quality of their life or their functioning.
Do they do well with a situation such as, applying for work or gaining gainful employment, that sort of thing?
I think it's highly dependent on the person because, like you said before, autism has a very wide range of, mm-hmm. of both functioning levels and characteristics of people.
Sure.
And oftentimes, it might depend on other issues that people are dealing with. There is a very high co-occurrence rate of other conditions along with autism that might make it more difficult for a person to get a job or to continue in school.
We hear about educational institutions like Landmark University and Southeastern New Hampshire that have programs that specialize for children with special or young adults with special learning needs. And would someone who, let's say, is in high school, would they be more inclined to be directed toward a place like that type of higher education institution to continue on so that they have the ability to have instructors and administration that understands the situation and can develop a program that works for them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would certainly be helpful. And I think, certainly there are teams of counselors and special educators who are aware of those programs and can direct families to them, mm-hmm. but we still hear a lot of families who are trying to navigate these issues on their own and trying to figure out what is available to their student mm-hmm. after graduation and struggling to do so. I think we're just starting to see the dawn of programs that are more tailored to helping young college students with autism mm-hmm. and to helping people in their areas of employment. And so, we're still sort of at that early stage where information is just starting to get out about these programs and people are starting to do some experimenting to see what actually does help people. Mm-hmm. We're still at that early stage of learning.
What, through the study that you have conducted, what are the hopes? What is the, what do you hope to achieve through this study? What are, what's the goal?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we just published in April the National Autism Indicators Report, mm-hmm. and it's a report that will come out periodically, but this one focused specifically on the transition to adulthood,
okay.
and we wanted to know how young adults were faring into their early 20s. And
What did you see? What kind of, to me, that would be quite interesting because with all of this becoming more in the spotlight in the public eye, that that age range would be extremely important to, you know, to consider and where they're going to go and what their future is going to be like.
Right. It's the last age range, really, where we have something that's mandated that students who are receiving special education services, as you probably are aware, have to have a transition plan for how to facilitate employment and continuing education and independent living as they enter adulthood. And so it's a great age for us to look to see, okay, so what actually happened to those people? And because once they leave special education, then they don't have the assurance of services, and no one is really following them forward to see what happened.
Yeah.
So, you know, if we look at this last glimpse, what we see is that about half of students will go on to have at least one job sometime in their early 20s. Mm-hmm. About one-third will go on to continued education. Another portion of them will do both of those things, school and work. But then there's one-third that does not enter school and does not enter work, and we consider those people to be disconnected, where they haven't actually transitioned into an outcome that they intended to transition into. And that's the group that we're really most concerned about.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to say. And through this study, you're probably hoping to be able to come up with some kind of counseling or a method of helping that one-third become more connected and become part of the society, everyday life and everyday society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely that's the next step. You know, it's surprising how little information we have nationally about just what we talked about, the group that doesn't have any help and doesn't isn't being connected to anything. So really that was our first mode of operation here, is to figure out, you know, what those numbers were. And then certainly beyond just documenting the gaps in what is happening, we're now starting to look at what is out there that is actually working in our communities. What are the important components of transition, and what are the important components of interventions and services that actually help people to thrive better?
And did you get, in the study, did you happen to find out what a rough number, or I know it's hard to get an exact number, but a rough number of how many young adults are actually suffering with autism?
We, you know, can look at census numbers, and we can look at numbers from national surveillance of autism that's conducted. So there are the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has surveillance centers across the United States, and they look at medical records to determine approximately how many 8-year-olds have autism. Mm-hmm. So we know those numbers, and then we can look at how many people are around the age of 18 in the United States. And when we do that and we come up with our calculations, which are rough estimates, we find that about 50,000 18-year-olds are leaving high school every year and entering into the adult service system. So around 50,000 or so.
Do you have a timetable set for what you'd like to do, you know, with the results of the information from the study on getting a program started, maybe either, you know, locally in the Drexel University community, or even on a nationwide basis through independent organizations?
One thing that we would like to do is to serve as a resource for other agencies, program planners, policymakers, and helping them understand the, you know, the larger national situation of whether things are improving or not improving. So we consider ourselves almost the Census Bureau of Autism,
right,
in, you know, producing indicators like these, because they're actually, you know, not available from other sources in terms of this set of transition age youth. So, you know, that's something that we're really interested in helping people to do, is to conduct better measurement, tracking over time whether people in their communities are actually doing better with accessing employment and continuing education and getting the services that they need. So that's one thing that we would really like to see.
Is it impossible to detect autism? Like at birth, you know, we have the Apgard rating for newborn babies, and that that's used to, you know, determine a lot of different factors. In that number, that EPCARD number, is that something that can also show what child would be more likely or not to to be prone to autism?
It seems like every year the age at which we can start to have some indicators of autism decreases. The youngest that I've seen is about 6 to 12 months, where we start to get some indicators of social interaction, responsivity, eye gaze, different things like that. And in autism, we don't really have any biological markers for it at this point. There's nothing that we can look to, in a person's body to say that they have autism, but it's only diagnosed behaviorally. So it's difficult to do that, I think, in an infant. Around a year, 2 years of age is about the earliest that we can start to pick out markers of it at this point.
What type of markers are we looking for, or what would put a parent maybe into a mindset that said that, maybe I ought to look further into this? What usually is the behavioral mm-hmm. pattern that you see?
I think early on, there is something called joint attention, where both the baby and the parent are interacting together and attending to the same thing. So maybe rolling a ball back and forth, and they're both, looking at the ball and looking at each other and shifting their eye gaze, those sorts of things. And then a little bit later, it's responsivity, things like being able to turn and look when someone calls your name, mm-hmm. And then certainly indicators with language mm-hmm. About, whether that child is speaking on time or not. And then even prior to language, things with gestures, like being able to point at things to show that to someone else, pointing to an airplane in the sky and directing, the mom or dad's attention to that. Those are social interactions that you tend to see emerge early on and typically develop in children, but might be delayed or absent in children with autism. And then finally, there, are more unusual behavioral characteristics that you might see. Anxieties, repetitive behaviors. You hear a lot of, families talking about, their children are absorbed in one thing, like trains or alphabet letters or things like this, instead of being interested in broader things in the world around them.
The interesting thing, too, that I have observed just from talking to other people, in our area here, is that the absorption into one particular thing makes it almost where it's like a comfort zone for the child, and they go there because they're comfortable there, they feel safe there, and it's not a real challenging experience because they focus their interest in that particular hobby or that particular subject, things like that.
If you hear adults with autism talk about what their daily lives are like, oftentimes they will relate just how overwhelming it is in terms of sensory input to cope with the world around them, of touch and smell and lights and movement. And so that helps me understand a little bit better about what it must be like to be a child and not have as many resources for knowing how to comfort yourself and dealing with just sensory overload like that. So that might be one clue, yes.
I always often think, too, that a lot of times when somebody or a child is diagnosed with autism, they feel that, that's the limitation. But really, hidden in there is, there could be brilliance hidden in there as well. Quite an intelligent person that is just having to deal, like you said, with all of the sensory challenges that go on day to day, but they have this extreme knowledge in a lot of the people who are victims of autism.
Absolutely. I think it's really important to focus on also strengths and value of people with autism, and many things that they donate back to our knowledge base and our communities. And I think that is one of the possible answers for thinking about employment and thinking about how we embrace mm-hmm. people better in our communities, is to recognize those strengths and areas of of brilliance and intelligence, like you said, too.
Yeah, I mean, it's just amazing. Where do you expect to go from here now that you've completed this study? What is the next step, and what do you see for the future of the research you've done, and if you're going to do, you know, further research into the subject?
Right. Well, one of the things we're committed to is to continuing to try to convey this type of information to the people who need it in an understandable way. So mm-hmm. people who need this these type of statistics for policymaking or program development. Mm-hmm. So we will continue that, and we're launching a website and a series of fact sheets that goes with this particular report. And then we will be producing other reports too, focusing on similar information about how people with autism are faring in our nation. And then in addition to that, we're launching a program too, looking at emerging practices, so identifying what is working in our communities around us, helping people to measure that better so that we can tell better what's working in practice. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be a really exciting area of development, I think.
Is there a fear that maybe, you know, we become so label crazy in our society that we live in today, and ADHD and ADD and all of that they were like buzzwords. Do you hope that it does not become a buzzword, or does not just become a bin to throw a person into autism because of some of the way that it's handled in the media?
You know, some people have certainly suggested that with the increase in numbers, that perhaps it's just, you know, a quote fad diagnosis. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think if you speak, though, with families and with adults with autism, though, especially those that are struggling to find help, I don't think that, you know, we have overdiagnosed to that extent. I mean, certainly people are still, when you're, you know, age 25 and you've never had a job and you've never continued at your education and you're living, you know, with your family still and haven't experienced independent living and are having trouble connecting socially, you know, there are a fair number of people like that out there. And I think that's where we need to keep our attention directed, is to that group of people.
You have to stay focused. Well, Anne, thank you so much for taking time to join us on the program this morning. You've given us a lot
of... You are welcome. Thank you.
A lot of interesting information. I'd like to check back with you in the future. And if you have anything that, you know, new developments or new research material that you'd like to share, we'd be more than glad to, you know, have you back on the radio program to discuss it again.
Okay.
That's Anne.
That's wonderful. And if people are interested, and we are the Life Course Outcomes Research Program, and you can find us on Twitter and Facebook. That's where we post our updates for our research and our information products as we release them.
Terrific. And is the study available on a website somewhere where someone could take a family could take a look at the information that's been gleaned through the study?
It is. If you visit the A.J. Drexel Autism Institute website, you can find our Life Course Outcomes Research Program, and the Autism Indicators Report is linked from there.
Terrific. Thank you. Again, thank you so much. I hope you enjoy the rest of the summer. And it was, again, enlightening to have you on. Anne Rue from the A.J. Drexel Autism Center at Drexel University in Philadelphia. The show's The Beacon. I'm Bill Jurek.
Thank you, Bill.
Hey, Mom. Why is the sky blue? Why don't animals talk? Why do dogs have wet noses? Why is an 11 pronounced 1T1?
Kids ask a lot of questions.
Why do I have a belly button?
But you don't have to know every answer.
Why is the ocean salty?
Because you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent.
Why are there 50 states?
There are thousands of children in foster care who don't need every question answered.
Why is pizza round?
They just need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
Now, it's Sebastopol and...
Katati. Yes.
That's right. I had a way down. Oh, hot toddy. Katati.
Hot toddy, right.
That's right.
That's how you used to remember.
And now you give me another one. Kermit, California?
Hemet.
Hemet. Hemet.
have it, California.
Is it, like one of those places that you drive by that has a little rusted out trailer that they use?
No, you know what? It's actually a very like thriving community of active seniors. I mean, it's a city, so it's not like you don't pull into a driveway and there's the community. It's a city, but it's essentially a retirement community.
Is it down there where it gets like to be 177 degrees?
So hot, hot.
And you know what the old people love? They still walk on long sleeve
shirts. They do, and they're polyester pants.
That's right.
And I can say that because my grandma really—I mean, she's so fashionable. Like I love her. She has ruby like encrusted sunglasses.
Oh my lord!
She wears her polyesters. She rocks them.
It's that generation that brought them to us.
Heck yeah!
They're gonna bring them back again, even though we try to throw them out.
I think they might die out with that generation. I don't think polyesters really caught back on.
I don't think so. But you know what? Juan Suarez, who is our intern and comes up with some great ideas for our program here, is going to be talking to another member of the senior program at the Chicago Lighthouse.
That's correct.
So we'll have to see what that's all about. And I'll tell you a funny story that he told me about. Not a funny story, but it's actually, this actually could be the lady I'm talking about. So should we listen?
Let's do it.
Good morning. I'm Juan Suarez. My guest today is Mary Snyder. Good morning, Mary. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing good.
That's great. How long have you been coming to the seniors program?
Actually, I just started back in April or May of this year. It hasn't been really long because a friend of mine told me about it. And we came down together and decided to have some fun.
When you say fun, and you know what, that's one of the things that I right away when I went down to make my pitch to bring you guys and to want to do these interviews, one of the things that caught my attention immediately in that room was there's a ton of energy. There seems to be a lot of camaraderie there. What is it that makes it so much fun and crept, obviously got your interest and wanted to come here?
Well, I got the chance to meet some new people, probably not too many my age. I'm on the younger end of senior, but still in that category. Just a lot of fun people. We have activities that are fun to do, interesting to be part of, and basically to meet new friends and have a good time.
What are some of those activities? I understand that there's a lot of different things that there are helping you with, from health to fitness to other things. What are some of the things that they are offering here in that program?
Well, we have this thing called Coffee Clutch twice a month. We have a stretching and strengthening exercise class. It's all done from the convenience of a chair. We have art and crafts project once a month. We have bingo or family feud, so it's kind of like game afternoon. We have, those are just a few of the ones I go to, but I have enjoyed myself.
I understand there's also, is there technology involved with this as well?
They do have beginning and intermediate computer class.
That's great.
And they also have a writing circle where we come and not necessarily learn how to write because we are unable to write, but kind of writing stories and poems, and a couple people were interested in possibly writing a book, and I've written some little passages that hopefully I can put into a collection to give my son someday to remember mom.
Speaking of mom, let's talk about you a little bit, Mary. Obviously, you're here at the Lighthouse, and the Lighthouse is a special place for people who are either have lost their vision completely or are losing their vision. Let's talk about you. What happened with you, and what's happening with you in terms of your vision loss?
I was born with congenital cataracts, so I've been visually impaired since day one, and I have what they call a nystagmus. I think that's when your eyes are uncontrollably moving, and I've had four surgeries on them when I was 13 months old, 2 years old, 4 years old, and 7 to correct it somewhat, but that was done all the way back in like the 60s, and so what's done is done, can't be changed.
Yeah.
Even with a lot of modern things, people are always telling me, oh, you could have this done or that done. No, I don't think so. But it hasn't stopped me from being myself and doing things. I'm raising an almost 16-year-old son right now and have my own home in Des Plaines.
And one of the things that encouraged me and, of course, and inspired me was to talk about what is and even in it, and I hear it in your energy and in your voice now, that when you say it hasn't stopped you, obviously at one point in time you probably had a career. What did you do, and what do you want to continue to do, and hopefully here at the Lighthouse that can help you to continue to strive to do something else with yourself?
Well, I used to be in the vending program, the State of Illinois organization, and I also did child care work for a family for like 9 years. I practically raised those kids, so I was like their second mom. And I've often thought of going back into the vending program just as an employee. I was never a manager, but I wouldn't mind being an employee. It gave me an income, gave me something to do and every day, and look forward to being with the customers I served. And I would love to go back to it. But until then, you know, I'm trying to keep myself busy with activities and things down at the Lighthouse, down, out in my own neighborhood, keeping up with my high school age son.
I was going to say, keeping up with a teenager, I'm sure that's a plateful right there.
Oh, it's a challenge, trust me. It's not an easy job.
My guest again this morning is Mary Snyder. She's visually impaired, but she's one of those, again, who, just because you're losing a little bit of your vision, or you've lost some, or you are totally have lost completely visually impaired, she's proving that once again there is life after vision loss, and there is something that you can do to get past those barriers through friendships and through community and through programs like we have here at the Chicago Lighthouse. Mary, how difficult was it for you coming through school, and also through, how challenging was it through school and through your career at the vending program?
Well, my school years, I went to a regular Catholic grammar school and all-girls Catholic high school. No special needs things were done for me. Well, for a while, there was a special teacher that used to come out and help me. And unfortunately, it never went into high school. It was supposed to. So I struggled with the regular print books and no special adaptive assistance, no visual aids, anything. And I was able to graduate high school with more credits than I needed to graduate. And I keep telling my son, hey, if your mom can do it, you certainly can do it, and you don't even have any disabilities.
There you go.
I encourage him to stay in school and do his best.
There you go. That's great. What do you want to tell people who are listening, who have, let's just say, a person who is up in their years and is looking for something to do, and maybe they might have a little disability or probably looking for some place to join? Would you recommend the senior center here at the Chicago Lighthouse?
Oh, definitely. It's a great place to meet people and have a great time and do some things for yourself and learn new things, meet new people. I'm a people person, so I'm glad I came.
In your hardest days, Mary, when you're by yourself and you know things are not that great, what do you do, tell yourself, and what do you tell people to encourage them that they've got to continue to move on, and no matter what, you got to keep going?
Well, sometimes I think there's people out there with worse situations than me, worse disabilities than me. I try to wake up every day with a positive attitude and ready to hit the day full force and get things done, and that it can be done. There are ways to get things done and to enjoy yourself, and don't stay home. Get out there, take a walk. I don't know, just do things. Have a positive attitude like I do.
That's great. That's absolutely wonderful. And right now, what do you want to do in the near future for yourself and for what's going on with you over at the seniors program here at the Lighthouse?
I mean, I like coming to the different programs. Hopefully they'll have more things that we can do and that I can be a part of. I don't know, just be out there and do things. That's all I can think of.
Well, thank you so much, Mary. I'm glad you were the first of hopefully the rest of your colleagues and your friends at the Senior Center that I will be talking to, because it's amazing stories and great inspiration, and continued continued success to you, and I hope you can get yourself back into a program and you can continue to do what you want to do. And with your attitude, I'm sure you will. Thank you so much for joining us here on The Beacon. I'm Juan Suarez, and join us again.
Right now, we're going to turn up the beat with you. Let us turn up the beat.
You got it, baby.
How you doing? And what kind of factoids are you going to share with, or is this a recipe week?
So should we go? No, it's not a recipe week. So should we go with the, you want the good news or the bad news? I'll do one this week and one next week. I'll let you pick. Good news or bad news?
Well, we had good news last week, so we might as well hit him with bad news.
Bad news. So this isn't, it's not bad news. There's a list out there called the Dirty Dozen, and it's essentially the top 12 produce items that are infested with pesticides.
Lee Marvin was in that movie.
It's a different movie, darling.
Oh, I see.
This is completely different. This is not a country western from...
This was about war. Trini Lopez.
Oh, yes, that's right. That's right. Yeah,
Telly Savalas was in that movie.
Right. You know, yeah, no, this is something different.
Really?
It is.
I could go on.
Would you mind?
All right, go ahead.
Thank you. So the Dirty Dozen are the, in testing, these are the top 12 produce items that they recommend you buy organic. Now, organic is expensive. Like, you know what? I'm going to preface this with saying Trader Joe's has very affordable organic produce. So I love my Trader Joe's. But in general, and I know that this is a complaint that a lot of people have, you know, a lot of these, the healthier foods kind of pander to the more affluent demographic because they're just expensive. You know, people who live in you know, poorer areas can't necessarily afford this. So they've sort of made this list to say, okay, if you're not going to go organic all the time, which I'll admit I don't go organic all the time. I find some of it, you know, too pricey for me. This is a list of 12 that if you want to eat them, please go organic if you can, because these are the ones that are most infested with pesticides. So get out your pencils. Yes, they are.
Pencils down, ladies and gentlemen.
And this list is, apples is the number one, which unfortunately is probably the most consumed fruit, but it is the number one fruit that tests the highest on the pesticide scale.
Really?
Yep.
Wow.
Yep. They spray the heck out of those apples.
Well, an apple a day keeps the doctor in your home.
Yeah, exactly.
Go ahead.
Peaches are come up second on that list.
Oh, no, don't say that. I know. I love peaches.
Well, eat organic. You can eat organic. I know. There's the face. Nectarines.
I don't care. Take them or leave them.
Yeah, I'm not crazy about strawberries. That's a big one for me.
Well, yeah, but how about if you wash them?
It doesn't do anything. Now, I have heard, and I do this with
but
my
But I mean, if you scrub them with Comet and something like that?
Oh, Lord, come on. Now, what I have heard, and I've done this with my produce, I can't vouch for how effective it is because I'm not a scientist. I'm not testing the pesticide levels. But I have heard that if you wash your produce with a 3-to-1 ratio of water to vinegar, so you can't taste it. So it's essentially 3 cups of water to 1 cup of vinegar. That's how I measure it out. And you let your produce soak for about 10 minutes. That rumor has it that does help to wash away a lot of the pesticide. I can't vouch for it again, but I do that with my produce. So if you want, you can soak your produce for about 10 minutes in a 3-to-1 ratio, vinegar to water, more water than vinegar. But you can't taste the vinegar. Once you rinse it off, it's gone. You don't taste it. And it actually does keep your berries fresher longer. That I can attest to.
Okay.
So you can certainly do that. It's an option.
And then
we've got grapes, celery, spinach, bell peppers, cucumbers.
Why is it everything I like?
I know, because it's all delicious. Cherry tomatoes.
I love cherry tomatoes.
I know, me too. Snap peas and potatoes are...
Potatoes?
Yep, on the Dirty Dozen, baby.
Jeez.
Next week, however, I will have a list of the Clean 15, which are the top 15 produce items that test the lowest on the pesticide scale. So these are the top 15 that are probably okay to buy traditionally. You don't need to buy them organically.
How about sweet corn?
Sweet corn is on the top, is on the Clean 15.
Oh, okay. We'll do that next week.
Yeah, okay. Don't give it away. Right.
So now where else can they find this list of
I'll favorites? Post it on Facebook, on our Facebook page, which is Chicago Beacon, or you can follow us on Twitter at Chicago Beacon.
James Brown.
Ow!
No, maybe that's not the right Brown. But there was another guy, one of the football players who turned actor.
Okay.
He was in that Dirty Dozen movie, too.
Oh, I don't know. That's well before my time.
You know, if I could sit down long enough, I could probably think of more characters
from
that
movie. I'm sure you could. I'm sure your little wheels are going to be turning for the rest of the day. Right. I can see it.
Every day, every couple of minutes, I'll be calling you. Yeah. Saying, oh, and then there was...
just text me. Yeah, just text you?
Yeah. That way you can ignore me.
Exactly.
I'm so excited I could text again because I got an iPhone back again.
That's great. It's great to be able to text you.
I know.
It is.
It's the only way she answers anything.
It's true. It's a true story.
Tom Persky has got some very interesting things coming up in Tom's Corner this week.
He pretty much always does.
And matter of fact, he is so excited that we had to bring Brian Hawkins back to kind of
corral
kind
him.
Of sit on him, you know, and make sure that he gets
keep
all the
track.
Information out. That's right.
Gotta keep him on track.
We call the segment Tom's Corner, and there's a good reason for it. Because all his years in school, that's where he felt most comfortable. Was in, they actually named it in the classroom.
You are so ridiculous.
Here they are.
Tom's Corner coming at you once again. I'm Brian Hawkins with the man himself, Mr. Tom Persky. Good morning. How are you?
Brian Hawkins, how are you?
I'm good. I'm great. And, you know, we were talking before we came in to tape the show. And you brought up something that I had never heard before. The fact that studies have been done and it has shown that folks with low vision need 6 to 7 tools.
Yeah.
In order to be considered, what, functioning well?
That's correct. There's so many things that I think are misconceptions about low vision that people can get a really strong pair of glasses that might be the thing that really helps them,
mm-hmm.
or a real strong magnifying glass. But each of the things that are very, very helpful to people with low vision only comprise a small subset of what they want to do in their everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember when I was first diagnosed and I was having difficulty reading, I was given a +8 pair of full view reading glasses. And so they looked kind of like Coke bottles. And the thing about 8-diopter lenses is you have to hold things 5 inches away. So for the audience, if you're good at math, we will call it the 40-inch rule. So 40 inches divided by the power makes the focal distance. So if those glasses would have been 10 diopters, I would have had to hold it 4 inches away. 12 diopters, even closer. So mm-hmm. the stronger the lens, the closer you have to hold things. And so that's a difficult, huge adjustment for people. In really having to hold things close and with a pair of reading glasses. Another thing that can be added to your toolkit would be a good reading light. So being able to have the light over the shoulder of your better seeing eye. You want the light lower than your eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And you want it kind of shining down on a 45-degree angle in between your glasses and the paper. So a lot of patients start out with like +6 diopters, something like that. So they've got enough room to get that light right over the shoulder, right where they need it. Studies show that the light, just having the light, is like having 4 extra diopters of power. And people often overlook that.
Mm-hmm.
So then I think the second thing would be like having a similar power or a little bit stronger power in some kind of a magnifying glass that you can carry with you. It could be illuminated or non-illuminated. So I remember when I first started, I used a 5X, which is 20 diopters. And then I was able to see small print, price tags, you know, in the store, menu in a restaurant, that kind of a thing. Those are real helpful for people. But I was kind of embarrassed, you know, to have to use those in a lot of situations, you know. So I learned the trick of saying, tell me the top 3 things that people like to buy in this restaurant, so that it would give me their best dishes, and then I wouldn't have to be embarrassed at holding the menu 4 inches from my nose. But those days are over now. I don't care. I want to be able to do
your choice.
Exactly. So I don't worry about looking cool. I just worry about functioning, you know. And so with camera systems now, you can actually have a video magnifier where you can zoom in and see the smallest type print. at 10 times magnification or 15 times magnification. You can make the letters white on a black background. So we didn't have those little cameras in the old days. But those are starting to replace some of the people who were using optical magnifiers because it gives you such a range and you can just dial in with the buttons the size that you need in every situation. Mm-hmm. For seeing in the distance, I use a 6-power or 6X monocular telescope. So if you're good at math, let's say your vision is 20 over 200 or considered legally blind. If you're using a 6X monocular telescope to see in the distance, like if I'm walking down the street to see a sign above a store or the number on a bus, you take that bottom number, 200, and then you divide by the power of the lens, 6. So you can see it's just a lot, you know, gives you a lot better vision up close. Now, I still have a blind spot in the middle, so when I look through the telescope, I have to cheat. I have to look a little to the side, and that's called eccentric viewing.
Right.
And so that's a skill that you can learn, and you can teach yourself and just pay attention to where you look. And you can use that with your reading glasses. You can use eccentric viewing with your magnifying glass. You can use it with your telescope. Obviously, I have 2 or 3 times of wraparound sunglasses as part of my toolbox. So if it's a cloudy day, I have a bright amber lens. If it's a real sunny day, I have a deeper amber lens to protect. If there's snow on the ground, I have a 4% lens that blocks out all but 4% of the light. And then probably my most interesting tool when I travel through airports is my identity cane. So it's a white cane that folds up very small, fits in my pocket. Not to mention now these new tools. I use software, Zoom Text on my computer, and now with the iPad and the iPhone, we use those tools that are already built into that technology. So it's pretty amazing when you start to think about all the things. I think for a new person with low vision, the hardest part is trying to figure out what is out there to help me.
Right.
And then which tools work in which situations. That takes a long time. And it's not easy because there's an adjustment with every tool that you get and how you use it properly. And so people give up and stuff. So, but don't give up. It's really important that you work towards finding out all about all the tools that are necessary to help you read and function in an everyday life.
Is it the kind of thing where you just go about your life, and as you find yourself in different situations, you find that you need a solution to help you with your vision, so then you go and seek something out as opposed to trying to decide all at once everything that you'll need?
Yeah, I think that's probably the best, or what we say is a priority or top 10 list, you know, things that are the most important to you that you're frustrated doing or can't do anymore at all. Let's get some of those accomplished with a tool or one or two tools, and then go down the list and reprioritize, you know, every so often. So I tell people, go to a low vision exam every year or every 2 years, because your vision's changing and your top 10 list is changing.
Mm-hmm.
And so you need to keep up with what tools are out there to help you. And so you'll be surprised. Just, you know, I know in our technology, every month or two, there's 2 or 3 new products. So if someone hasn't been here in 6 months or a year, we have lots to show you and be able to explain things that are coming out that weren't out before.
Okay.
Yeah.
Those wonderful toys.
Yeah, exactly.
And one place that you can keep up to date on what's going on is at the road shows, and we've got some coming up.
We're coming up Wednesday, September 30th. We're going to be at Frankfurt at the Township Hall. Which is 11,000 West Lincoln Highway. That's a really nice venue. It's open to the public. It's free. It's from 10 o'clock to 3 o'clock. And we really like that venue in Frankfort, Illinois. October 6th, we're going to be at the Chicago Lighthouse North at our Glenview location. So we're going from way south to way north. And that is also from 10 o'clock to 3 o'clock. Our Chicago Lighthouse North is 222 Waukegan Road in Glenview. If you live downtown, there's a train that stops at the Gulf Station. It's on the Milwaukee District North Line, and it's literally a block and a half from the train station. So people that live in the city that want to come out to the show, I fail to mention that sometimes, but it's the way that I get to Glenview.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really very easy if you live in the city. October 14th, we're also going to be out at Park Ridge in the northwest suburbs at the Maine Township offices. So we've got some really good shows coming up, and we hope to see you there. A lot of people have been listening to our show and come to our shows. Just last week, we had a couple of families that had not heard the show before, and they said, "We want to see that guy, Tom." And that was great, because we were able to meet and sit and talk and then show the devices that were the most helpful to them. So,
right, and you're doing that conference in October, right?
We are, yeah, the October conference, which I forgot to talk about, but let's talk about that as it gets closer.
Right. Yeah. Okay. We'll do that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, he's Tom Persky. He's got all the technology, and he's out there bringing you the roadshow so you can come and see him. I'm Brian Hawkins. This is The Beacon.
Well, that's going to do it this week. Couldn't come up with any more actors.
No, you've got time.
One who's definitely not part of the Dirty Dozen is Dr. Janet Slick. She's our
CEO. She's one of the Clean 15.
That's right.
We'll talk about
and
next
that's
week.
How she eats very healthy foods,
that's right.
too. So that'll do it. Thank you to her for supporting us with the Beacon program and now into our eighth year. And also
many thanks to Friedman Place, who is also to thank. For being with us for almost eight years.
Now that you're almost 40, should we bring the cue card a little
Maybe.
Closer so you can see it?
Maybe. Oh, I don't think I'm there quite yet, but give me a couple
close.
More years. In eight more years, we'll definitely... Oh, my gosh. Could you imagine if we're still sitting here in 8 years?
Yeah.
That'd be crazy.
Oh, gosh. Thanks to Juan Suarez for a great feature on our seniors program at the Lighthouse, and also Sandra Murillo, our associate producer, who helps get things organized for us and keeps us on schedule with some very interesting topics, and the one and only Brian Hawkins.
Our very favorite.
That's going to do it for us. I'm Bill Jurek.
I'm Amy Kleeman.
We'll see you back here on The Beacon.